The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Coming up, who are we and where are we going? Official census statistics show a snapshot of an increasingly diverse country, but one with vast regional differences. At the same time, the government finds itself involved in a civil rights battle against its own backbenchers. Should the institution of marriage be extended to gay people in future? And how should new rules apply to churches, mosques, and other religious institutions? What may sound like questions for an Oxford seminar could be about to shift the political landscape. So, joining me to discuss this, we have the Conservative MP Nick Herbert, together with Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland and Hugh Muir. A warm welcome to you all. Britain is less white than it was 10 years ago. It's less Christian and also has a lower proportion of homeowners. There are more degrees, but fewer weddings, and all of this is changing very fast. On the face of it, that sounds like bad news for the Conservative Party, whose bedrock support has traditionally been white, mortgaged and married. Nick Herbert, as a Conservative MP, do you think that's hamming it up too much? Do you think there's some challenging trends there for your party here?
I think that is hamming it up too much. I mean, the Conservative Party has always succeeded historically by being a broad coalition and will need to succeed in the future by continuing to be a coalition. And that clearly will mean appealing to people from all backgrounds, different ethnic origins. I think there are big challenges for the Conservative Party, for instance, regionally, in terms of the support that we are drawing from the north and from cities. And some of that is about support from black and ethnic minority communities. Certainly, there are clear warnings for any party, for instance, from the United States, where the Republicans have found themselves disconnected from an entire new generation of people who've moved into the country and the Latino population in the case of the United States. But I actually think that there are fundamental conservative values about entrepreneurship and self-reliance and about the ability to get on and about striving, which actually could mount a very big appeal for people from the BME communities. I don't think there's anything necessary at all in the Conservative message which should be off-putting to them.
Johnny, you wrote about the Olympics, that that we'd found out with the opening ceremony who we were, and then these census statistics seem to lend some substance to Danny Boyle's vision, do you think?
It did feel like that we'd had this very impressionistic, quite sentimental sense of ourselves provided by the opening ceremony in particular, but actually right through the whole Olympic period. And central to that was this notion that we are now this many and various place, this very diverse place. And so, you know, the emblematic evening was the Super Saturday of Jessica Ennis, herself mixed race, Mo Farah, Somali origins, and then Greg Rutherford, the traditional white male face of British athletics. And there they were all triumphing on the one night. But that felt sentimental and anecdotal, and maybe even a kind of PR image. And then along came these numbers to give us the cold, hard facts and to say that we really are genuinely changing. If only now only 81% of Britons define themselves as white British, horrible phrase in the census lexicon. That's a big shift. 86% white when you include sort of white newcomers and white non-Brits, Poland and elsewhere. But you know, London for now, people for ages have been sort of saying, which is going to be the first minority city or whatever. And there's London now. Only 45% of Londoners say they're white British. You know, 60% are white if you include other people. But something very big is changing, and it shows you that whole Olympic thing wasn't just for show. There's something real going on here. And I thought Tony Travers, who I spoke to this week, put it very brilliantly. He's the sort of guru at the LSE, and he said, you know you get older every day, but it's very rare that somebody hasn't looked in a mirror for 10 years and then does look in the mirror and catches their reflection and thinks, wow, I've really changed. And he said, that's what this is like. We've known this has been going on, but now from the 2001 census to now, we've got it, the actual proof of it.
Hugh, Johnny picks up there on the difference between London and, I think the Northeast had one of these statistics percentage of people born abroad. It's an interesting one because it's not the same as ethnic minorities. It could be people born in air bases or whatever. And it's above all a sign of a more mobile world. But it's 5% in the northeast, about 35% in London. And yet London just elected Boris Johnson. So isn't Nick's thesis right?
Well, one of the things that Boris Johnson was able to do was not to repel minority communities in huge numbers. I mean, Labour tried to paint him as a candidate who would do that. I mean, in fact, he was able to overcome that quite well. But, I mean, Nick does raise an issue for the Conservative Party, because he's quite right. If you look at many minority communities, if you look at my own community, I'm from a West Indian Pentecostal evangelical tradition. They're very, very conservative. If you look at somewhere like London, there are huge, say, Pentecostal evangelical churches.
So do you mean Conservative Party voting, or do you mean
something else? Well, they're as potential Conservative Party voters, because they have, in many ways, quite conservative values. The problem the party has is, he mentioned it as a broad church. In a way, that's its blessing and its curse, because every time one wing of the party will say things that might be attractive to the Pentecostal congregations with 45,000 members, someone else in the Conservative Party says something that immediately repels them. And of course, one of the Conservative Party's best cards is immigration. And every time they play that card, those minority communities look at the Conservative Party and say, well, look, I may well share some of these values, but I can't possibly vote for that party, because look at what it really thinks of me.
Do you think, Nick, I remember when the 2010 election results were rolling in, and there were one or two seats that people really talked about the ethnic vote in relation to, Tooting being one that the Conservatives had been maybe expected to win on a good night. Of course, they had a good night and won lots of seats, but they didn't win that one. And people were saying quite quickly that was because there were lots of minorities there who weren't ready to vote for the Conservative Party nationwide, maybe even if some of them are ready to vote for Boris.
I think that the party is very alive to this issue. And if you talk to a high command in the party, I think they're very conscious about the importance of being able to mount a broad appeal. I mean, some of these policy areas are complicated. I mean, if you think about one of the areas where the Conservative Party might be mounting a broader appeal, if it takes a stance, for instance, on gay marriage, which is something we might talk about in a minute, actually, that's an issue that might appeal rather less to certain sections of the BME community. So I don't think you can have simplistic policy solutions to where parties need to go on this. I think it is about generally having a generosity of approach and mounting a broad appeal. That is also about what the party itself looks like and whether it is able to communicate with people. Now, you don't have to be of BME origin to be able to communicate with people from that background. And Boris Johnson, of course, completely proved that. But I think it has been important for the party that we are at last beginning to have more BME members of parliament, BME peers and so on. I don't think a party can look exclusively white in a country that is no longer like that. And so I think the whole agenda that David Cameron began, which was to broaden the base and appeal of the party, is by no means finished business, and we should not think that it is.
And can I just ask specifically, because you mentioned the Republicans, their difficulties in some of the Western states with immigrant communities, tough line on immigration policy. Theresa May is taking a fairly tough line, and I genuinely don't know, do you think this is a big problem with immigrant communities, to sort of say we're going to close down the routes of family reunion, for example?
Well, I think these are pretty difficult issues. I mean, it's absolutely clear that this is a really significant area of public concern, and it's one of the biggest and most consistent issues of public concern that registers week in, week out, is about the scale of immigration, or the scale that was under this country. And I think at the root of that are issues that aren't necessarily solely about race or a hostility to race. They're an issue about integration and about the extent to which people feel that communities have locked in to the country. And actually, the Olympics, for instance, was a massive antidote to that, because what it showed is that actually people were uniting completely around a sense of belonging to a country and competing for a country. I happen to think that there is so much more to be positive about in all of that, in terms of the way actually communities have integrated and do share a kind of common sense of culture and what it is to be British. And I think the Olympics proves that. So I don't think you can dismiss some of the concerns that are around that and have been around issues relating to public services and so on. It seems to me that the balance is to be able to say, look, we do want a sensible immigration policy that will command widespread public support, but that cannot be translated into an apparent hostility to the very people who are living in our own country. And that is a very important balance for politicians when they're speaking about these issues to try and achieve.
Well, let's just focus in now on one aspect of what was in the census, which is the apparent drop-off in the number of people who are considering themselves as religious, and then some of the ramifications of that. There was an increase from, I think, 15% to 25% in the proportion of people who said no religion. And by coincidence or not, Jonathan Friedland, in the same week, David Cameron confirms that there will be some form of gay marriage.
Yeah, I think the thing about religion is fascinating, partly picking up something that you were talking about there with Nick, and Nick said before about the comparisons with the United States. I now feel, as somebody who's made a good living making comparisons between British politics and the United States, that we almost need to start sort of either retiring the comparison or at least attaching to it a huge health warning, particularly because this point about religion. You know, the importance of faith in American politics is, if not central, so core to understanding the positions of all sides. And yet it is almost absent now from the British public sphere when you're getting to the point where 25% say they are of no religion. And this huge, you know, drop off a cliff in the number of self-declared Christians from 72%, I think, to 59 or lower. That is just huge. And it does mark us out in huge contrast with the United States, first of all. But even with continental Europe, where very strong Catholic churches in Spain or Italy, you know, France, Ireland, that's not part of the continent, but the point is that we stand alone a bit in this godlessness that is a big, big part of British life. We're the most, in perhaps, secular country in the whole industrialised world. So it means comparisons are going to be difficult. I think the introduction of gay marriage is a fascinating point, firstly because it does distinguish British conservatives from their counterparts in the United States, who've tied themselves up in such knots over this issue. But on the other hand, I do feel that it's sort of become a bar that's quite easy for a lot of conservatives to clear, and they think that if they've done that, they've done the whole modernising package. I agreed with hearing what Nick was saying before about there's a whole lot more work to be done with with black and ethnic minority voters, but I think somehow I sense in a lot of the commentariat as well, they feel once they've checked that box of is supporting equal marriage, the whole deal is done and they can adopt extremely right-wing positions on every other issue, but look, I'm terribly modern and progressive on this issue, and I think that's a danger for them.
Now, Nick, you're obviously a conservative and you're in a civil partnership. Johnny's saying we've just got to tick this box, but having spoken up about this in Parliament this week, does it feel that easy? Does it feel like it's a box that's the next question obviously is then what next? But just getting this box ticked, is that going to be a big struggle, or do you think the parliamentary party is now one round to it?
No, it hasn't felt easy. I mean, clearly, you know, it's dividing opinion in the parliamentary party. I mean, I think the first issue has been the sort of why do we need to do this? We've got civil partnerships and actually we could just stick it at that. You know, why are you raising this issue? Well, actually, the public are pretty clear about this. Some interesting polling done this week for the Freedom to Marry group, which I set up along with other conservatives this week, showed that a majority of the public are in support of gay marriage, and actually only a minority agree with the position to stick to say, you know, civil partnerships are enough. That's less than a sixth of the population. There's a tiny minority now of the country who are opposed to civil partnerships altogether, only 7%. I mean, what a fascinating change. Something that was controversial at the time has now become completely embedded in our society. But the longer this debate has gone on, the more strongly I feel that it is actually really quite difficult for people like me and for gay people to sort of jab a finger in my chest and say, you should put up with civil partnerships. And the very ferocity with which that is done only serves to highlight the difference between marriage as an institution and the civil partnership that I'm in. And it's, you know, it's not enough just to say, oh, well, there are legal rights that attach to civil partnerships that are pretty much the equivalent of marriage. The point is that some people are trying to say you should not be admitted to this institution. And that is not far removed from saying that is where you sit on the bus. And that is why I think actually in the end this is really quite an important issue and one that I think has to be won. I think it will be, because I think most members of Parliament will vote for this, and I think the House of Lords will vote for it too.
So Hugh, symbols matter, as Nick says, but I thought the symbols got a bit muddled up this week, because before Maria Miller's day in the spotlight, we heard lots of things at the weekend, David Cameron talking about potentially people, gay people being able to get married in church. And then on the day we had this thing called a quadruple lock, and I won't try and remember all of its bits, but one of them was that the Church of England is not only going to be allowed to not perform gay marriages, but it's going to be banned in law from doing so. It's going to take another Act of Parliament. So do you think there's a bit of appeal to the country, the liberal country Nick talks about, and then appeal to the party on the day on the detail?
I think that there's a muddle, and I think that in a way it will be good for David Cameron and for the party to be able to take this forward, but it's so messy that you wonder if, to some extent, it doesn't backfire. It almost has a kind of clause four element about it in trying to get through something that will be a defining measure for his party. But it's strange if Nick says that most of the public are in favour of it, then you do wonder about the party. Then if you're having such difficulty getting it through, if it's such a mainstream measure as regards the general public, then why are Conservatives at sixes and sevens about whether or not they want to do it? And I think this is almost showing the kind of relative weakness of David Cameron's position. And there's something that seems so eminently reasonable to the general public, and yet he's having such trouble just getting a straightforward measure through.
I mean, I think there are a couple of things to say about that. I mean, first of all, it is older people who are less likely to be supportive. The majority still are, but are less likely to be supportive, and particularly those that are religious. We know that most people of faith are supportive, but there is a minority who are not, and that is, you know, a minority that is likely to be active in Conservative Party associations, church-going people in the shires and so on, my kind of Conservative association. And I think they did need to be reassured that religious liberty would be protected too. And actually, I think that happens to matter. I mean, I think it's quite a big question about whether you should force a church to do this. There was some misunderstanding last week. There was a sort of belief that individual churches were somehow going to be able to do this. Well, that doesn't show much understanding of the Church of England. I mean, the Church of England, you know, is not going to have a position that it will allow individual churches to do this. At the moment, the Church of England is corporately saying, we don't want this to happen. And I think we actually should respect that. That's what religious freedom
is about.
You could
respect that without actually passing a law which bars them from doing it.
Well, no, the law at the moment prevents them from doing it. The reason you would have to have another law, it's a complicated technical matter, it's because of the church's own canon law. And it would require a much more complicated set of laws to change if the Church of England was to do it. And I think the question is, why do that when at the moment the Church of England doesn't want to? But remember, this is still a huge step forward because civil marriage is going to be legalised. Marriage for those church institutions, those faiths that want to do it, so the Quakers and the Unitarians and the liberal Jews, all of who this week said we want to do it. So I don't think we should dismiss that this is a massive step forward, but it was always going to be the case that at the moment the Church of England and the Catholic Church don't want to do it. And I think it would be a much bigger step to go and say, well, you must do it. I mean, I think that would be actually quite an infringement of religious liberty.
So you don't see these protections as doing any more than just allowing them to opt out effectively? I mean, it does seem odd.
It's actually a legalistic issue, which is to do with the fact that the Church of England is the established church and its canon law would have to be changed. And that's why actually there is this additional measure that affects the Church of England. But the fundamental position is really the same, which is that churches that want to do it ought to be allowed to, and by which I mean church organisations. And here, it's just the use of language you can see gets you into trouble because you start thinking of individual churches. Church organisations, religious denominations that want to do this ought to be able to. Those that do not want to do it ought to be protected. And that's actually a position that I think commands majority public support and I think will command the majority support in the House of Commons.
Right, well, we're going to have to call time on our service for this week. My thanks to Nick Herbert, to Jonathan Friedland and to Hugh Muir. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.